CliffCentral.com.
All right, we are live on a Tuesday morning, and we want to hear from you. You can drop us a comment in the comment section on the YouTubes, the Facebooks, and the Twitters. And if you want to email us, contact at cliffcentral.com. It is me with Mash and Lebang this morning. Mash, who's been interning with us at cliffcentral.com, he's been doing all kinds of work in the background. You may have seen him in some of our TikTok videos, in some of our YouTube stuff. So it's good to have you on, Mash. And how's it going for you for your first time this morning? Are you nervous or are you good?
I'm not nervous at all. I'm just wondering how on earth you guys wake up this early every single day.
Ask Simpiwe and ask Homo Lemo. They're up before any of us. They have to get things going before anybody else. Yeah, you're great. Not easy.
Because waking up this early is just a thing of you have to plan your whole day, your previous day around waking up this early. So sleep, going to bed extra early.
Do you know what the bonus is?
It's a bit different for me.
You know what the plus is that you get you get to do everything first, and you get to find out what's happening in the world before everyone else, and you get a bit of a head start on the rest of the people while they're all still kind of figuring out how to wake up and kind of rubbing their eyes and brushing their teeth. You've already been up for 2 hours. It's the way to do it. I'm telling you,
that is the way to do it.
All right,
absolutely. Even get here, then you.
A very pregnant Lebang is still with us with a baby that weighs 3.2 kilograms. So you've got to be really careful because you could topple over at any time, right? 3.2 kilograms extra is going to make you lean a little bit one way or the other.
That's literally my walk now. It's called the penguin walk. I waddle when I need to get anywhere, but I'm still able to pretty much do everything. Like, I'm still driving. I'm still like, nothing has changed except for the fact that there's a 3.2 kilogram human inside of me that's just kicking at any moment. I'm literally, and I was telling Mash earlier that I'm in Operation Get Baby Out. So I Googled like things to do if you want to, you know, naturally induce yourself. I am eating all the pineapples in the world. I'm drinking all these funny teas. I'm having way too much sex. It's just all trying to get this child out of me. But she clearly has no interest. She's just like, no, lady, you are not going to tell me what to do. So, like, on paper, I still have, like, 2 weeks to go. But I'm just like, please help me to help you, you know, to help us.
Oh, Lebang. Oh, Lebang, I lift 3 kgs at the gym. Oh, that baby's heavy.
How do you sleep? What position are you sleeping in?
I can only sleep on my right side with a pillow in between my legs. That's it. That's the only. I can't sleep on my back. And sleeping on my left is just a little bit uncomfortable because I get heartburn all the time. It is a bit chaotic, but that's the least of my worries. It's everything else. It's just like I'll be walking. I was in Santon yesterday, so I was walking, tra-la-la-la-la, and then I just felt this like, in my stomach, and I just kind of paused. I just looked around, and I'm like, okay, cool. Just keep it cool. Don't jump, Isa. This might be a contraction. Took a deep breath, and then just like started walking again slowly. So that's the real entertaining part is like, this can happen at any moment. Every 12 hours, there's like a real something going on in there.
Well, Tracy says if you get a strong foot massage and focus on the area around the ankles, ovarian bands are located there. If there's nothing stopping the baby from coming out, it works like a charm. Sure. Okay. Foot massage.
Wow.
I mean, who would say no to a foot massage anyway, right?
Not this girl. No.
And Lebang, is it possible to actually go to the hospital and have it delivered early?
Only if it's like an emergency, like a medical emergency. If I start bleeding heavily, if my, you know, if my water breaks unexpectedly, then sure, I have to go. But you can't just knock on the door and be like, "Hey guys, I need my child to come out early.
I've got a lunch at 5.
Unless I'm meeting up with Oprah at 6:30. So can you get this done? Chop, chop, chop. No, doesn't work like that. With getting a Caesar is the only thing you're in control of. When you've got like a scheduled Caesar, you choose a date. They tell you the exact time, and then you at least know. With this, it's like I'm literally just living, not knowing what's going to happen. You know, this child at any time can decide, and that screws me over because, I mean, I've got plans. I've got shit to do. I want to go on with my life, but I can't. I have to kind of just wait. So there's pros and cons, but more pros definitely than cons.
All right. So there's apparently an etiquette around this, and maybe we can help each other figure it out, and maybe we can help some other people too at the same time. If you have a friend who is maybe overdoing alcohol, maybe they're on drugs, maybe they've got a gambling addiction, some other kind of addiction, and you need to get them help, what is the way to introduce that into the conversation? The reason I'm asking this is because Lebang needs to know how it's okay and when it's okay, and is it rude to give someone contact details for a rehab facility if you're worried about them? Like, how do you... You don't just scribble it down on a piece of paper and kind of give it to them in their hand and say, hey, that's for you. Just, I thought you needed to know this. Like, how do you do this in a way that isn't how do you even broach the subject? So, I mean, this is a good question, and it may actually help a bunch of other people. I don't know. I've never advised anyone to go to rehab. Maybe there's some people I should have, but I'm not sure what the correct protocol is here. Does anybody know?
So the interesting thing, Gareth, is that I literally just saw like a little commercial on like the bathroom stall, like this and that rehab, we do this, is that. But what caught my attention wasn't the alcohol, the drug abuse. It was literally like the, are you depressed? Are you suffering from anxiety? Are you isolating yourself from people? That's why I was like, crap, I actually know somebody that is suffering from this very thing and has been in denial all their lives. Should I take a quick screenshot? Should I quickly take a picture and just send it to him casually? Should I just kind of make a thing out of it? Do we do an intervention? How do I actually just confront this thing and say, hey, this could be of value because I know you're unhappy and I want you to live a happier life. Try this out. It had nothing to do with, like, you know, the alcohol abuse and all that stuff. Was like, yeah, you know, classic rehab 101 stuff. But what stood out to me was that this place is claiming that they can assist you with, you know, other things like reconnecting with people, learning how to love again, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, damn, this is it. I'm in the bathroom stall and this is the ad I'm seeing. It's about where you are. It's about timing.
Gary says a rehab in a ad in a bathroom stall sounds like just the place. Don't know about that.
That's where I need to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sean says, be straightforward. Say, yo, bro, you have a problem and I want to help. Some people don't respond very well to that, hey? It really doesn't make a lot of people happy to know that you are onto them and that you think they have a problem and that they need some help. It can be very insulting for people. So you've got to approach it very carefully.
You have to be, and also approach it in a positive manner. As you said, it'll help them actually find love again and actually find the positive and the good back in their life, get some good back in their life. So actually approach it in that positive manner as opposed to the, you need help.
I'm scared, guys. I'm way too scared. I'm all worse. I feel like I'm going to be rejected. This person's actually just going to tell me to fuck off properly.
Just give it a shot either way.
Sure.
I don't know.
Because I also had a friend who actually I saw signs of depression because he was buying so much cake every day. Like, he'd buy half a cake every single day and actually every single day just eating half a cake. And and I knew that this is not normal behavior. Mm-mm. Nobody just eats half a cake every single day and also a slab of chocolate on the side.
Unless it's Chateau Gâteau, then.
But hang on a second. Like, this person must have got very, very fat in a very short space of time.
He did. He got very fat in a very short space of time. And it got to a point where, he didn't have a car at the time. So I was actually taking him to the shops every single day. So it was kind of my fault a bit.
Hang on. You would help this person. So this is a friend of yours. You would load him up into the car and then you would take him to a cake shop. He would buy a cake and a slab of chocolate. And then you would take him back home again.
Yes, I would. And I would also take him to a chicken restaurant, fast food joint.
Oh, okay, great.
And go through the drive-thru and get him wings as well.
You are what we call...
And then I'd take him home.
You are an enabler. That's what you call that. Right, Lebang?
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
So it was a bit difficult to confront him because I was the one actually taking him to these places to begin with.
Damn right. Dogozo's advice here is just leave them alone. It's always up to them. Once they feel it's time, they will seek help. Well, you know, that's maybe the hard truth, right?
I think it might have to be. Look, if it means watching a person literally deteriorate year after year, that may just be the my standpoint of I can't do much for you if you're not doing anything for yourself, yeah, type thing. And I worry that the day won't come where they realize that they need to seek help, and they're just fine living in this wallow and just kind of surviving versus actually living. But again, what can I actually do for somebody who's not willing to help themselves? Maybe I should just take this energy and focus on myself and just keep it moving. There's literally not much I can do. So, correct. You are right. Yeah. I'm just going to leave it.
I had
Fortunately, we live in an...
Yeah, go ahead.
Unfortunately, we live in an information-driven world. So if they don't want to seek the help themselves, because all the resources are available online, if they don't actually want to diagnose themselves and seek that help themselves, they don't want it. They just don't want it.
Yeah.
Inga's being funny. She says, tell us the truth, Gareth. Is that really what happened to Mbulelo? Cake eating. No, we're not talking about him.
Not
I promise.
A chance.
he's still fit as can be. But it's funny. A friend of mine, she said to me the other day, she was like, I think I'm gonna have to cut down on my drinking. So I said, what do you mean? She said, no, I really think it's a problem. She said she realized that it was a problem because she was drinking on her own in the middle of the week. And that was before lunchtime even. And I think that's usually a sign. That's when you know you've got problems.
Yeah.
I would say so.
And that's not even the first sign. That's not even like sign number one. That's like...
You already had step eight there.
Step eight, yeah. The red flag is now maroon, honey. It's you're knee deep in this. Mm.
The next step is now you're putting vodka in water bottles and going to work with that. That's the next step.
There are people who do that?
Yes, I actually watched an episode of Dr. Phil where he was a family came to, they actually bought the, I think it was a sister, one of their sisters, huh? To the show because she's an alcoholic. And then Dr. Phil is like, you came here with your own bottle. Let us smell that. And then they opened it on stage and it was vodka in there. That's really? When I realized that, yo, there are levels to this. Levels.
Wow.
Unfortunately.
That sounds wild. Filling a water bottle up with vodka and taking it to work. Mm-mm. I think at that point you're finished. Now, another thing that we've got to have an answer for this morning. I love when we solve people's social problems and we help people figure out, like Lebang, whether or not you... I mean, you've pretty much got the answer now from Ndogozo, who says just leave the person alone. And don't interfere if it's none of your business on that front. But... Mash has got his own problem here because he's got a friend, a roommate actually in this case, who cannot cook but keeps trying. And you can only take so many bad meals before you have to say something. And a lot of people I find watch these TV chefs, right? They watch these cooking programs on TV, and then they think if they just if they have the same mannerisms as these TV chefs, or if they do the stuff that the TV chef does while the camera's rolling instead of the stuff that they never show you while the camera's off, or the disasters and the mistakes that happen because they're trying to make a TV show. They don't really care about whether or not you can cook this thing at home. These people who watch those shows and then they think they are chefs and they think they've got this extraordinary ability just because they have the ingredients and they've got a kitchen and they've got hands. And they can't actually. I mean, like I admit... Mash and Lebang, I admit right up front, I'm a useless cook. I can do a few things, but when it comes to like baking or, you know, doing complicated dishes that you have to do over an hour or two, and there's adding this and taking that out, waiting for this to set and making that happen, I just don't have that skill at all. It's just not something I can do. This friend of yours obviously doesn't have the ability to realize that they're no good at this.
Yeah, I mean, there's been signs, you know, when we first moved in, there were small little signs, but I didn't actually take them to head. What finally actually just tipped me over was the other day she calls me and she's like, can you please send me a voice note of how you make pancakes? And I'm like, hey, bo, hey, I don't have time for this. I just sent her a link from YouTube. So and now she actually starts cooking these pancakes from YouTube. And now it's a thing of, she wants pancakes just for herself. So obviously you're not going to use many eggs. You're not going to use much ingredients because you're making for one person. The video I sent her, I didn't even watch it. it was making pancakes for like 10 people. So she followed these instructions letter for letter, word for word.
Yeah.
And she ended up with a huge bowl of batter. And then she tried to put all of this into the pan. And then when I got home, it was just a big fat mess. It was just globules. It looked like she was trying to make scones. I don't know what she was trying to do. Maybe she was trying to actually make a cake in a pan. I'm not too sure. But either way, I was just like, listen, this is not it. But great. I appreciate your effort. And but I actually want to tell her, like, okay, don't do this again. But I don't know how to say that in a polite way.
But Mash, what would you rather have? A roommate that doesn't cook at all and literally waits for you to cook everything?
Yeah.
Or somebody who's at least trying themselves out and failing at pancakes? Like, you'd rather eat a sloppy pancake than eat nothing at all when you get home? Because some roommates are just trash, dude.
But also, my thing is also I get home late. I'm always running the streets. So she can't wait for me either, because she's going to starve to death if she waits for me.
Let me help you, my friend. Two words: air fryer. That's it.
Here we go
just
again.
Get an air fryer for
here
the
we
apartment.
Go again. Here we go again. Lebung in this goddamn air fryer. All right, Mash, you don't know what this is, but I know a lot of people are listening to us this morning are tired of Lebung and this goddamn air fryer. She cannot stop talking about it. She is obsessed with this thing. She has made it such an issue that now I cannot help myself. Now, because of you, Lebung, everywhere I go and even on my phone, all I'm getting is air fryer ads. I think it's because you keep mentioning it everywhere.
It's not me.
It is you.
It's the gods. It's
what are the benefits?
The algorithm gods out there are looking out for you. You just said it yourself that you're not a strong cook and that you can do bare minimum. This will elevate you from bare minimum to you can have conversations about food. Now you can participate when people bring up potatoes, because now you can say chips, you can say wedges, you can say whatever. Just listen, guys, air fryer, this is your answer to all your problems. Mash, thank me now.
But what's the difference? What's the difference between an air fryer and an oven? Because I think they do the same thing.
No, honey. Number one, you don't need to use a lot of oil, number one, with an air fryer. Okay.
Ooh, oil is expensive, yeah?
You've started her off. No, she's going to talk about this for another hour. Thanks, Mash. Look what you've done.
And I can. And I'll send my invoice later. Listen, just change your life. You can do everything in an air fryer. You can bake. You can do bacon. You can do scones. You can figure it out. There's nothing that you can't do in an air fryer.
All right, you
just
know,
Google it. Aren't you on TikTok?
So I am on TikTok.
Uh-huh. Lebung,
yeah, Lebung, the search bar,
here's how you win me over on the air fryer thing. And I thought about this after our 25th discussion on air fryers, because you're obsessed with these things. It's cleaner, right? Your kitchen is not a mess because you could seal this thing up and it does all its stuff and you don't have like oil and fat all over the stove and all the usual shit. Is that true or is that bullshit?
It's absolutely true. It's what you're saying. Everything is literally compartmentalized with one little machine that kind of looks like a spaceship. And then you just open up that drawer and your food is cooked to what I can really call perfection. You know, it tells you, okay, cool. Hey, come check on me. It'll go, dwee, dwee, dwee. You come and you check. Look, if you want to save time, guys, if you want to save, like, I even have less dishes because I'm not busy with pots and pans and scraping and scrubbing everything inside that one air fryer.
Now you're talking. Okay, I like this. So Tiger, Corona's boring, Moonchild, Empty Apology, Saki, Elon is God, Ndogos, are they all saying, oh, love air fryers. Yes, it's true. And it uses less electricity, says Anna Marie. Lots of people.
There we go.
Yeah. Okay.
Need I say more?
All right.
I'm buying one this
Sean
afternoon.
Sean says no. It's bullshit.
There we go.
So okay. and these things, I even know how much they cost now because I got a WhatsApp about it, it came up on Instagram or something. I'm telling you, it's because you keep talking about it. My phone's sitting here listening to the show every day. It's you, Lebung.
You don't know it yet, but you already own it, Gareth. You don't know it yet, but you already own an air fryer. Stating the fact.
The day will come. The day will come when we all have a big air fryer reveal on the show, and I'll have to show you my air fryer that I bought because Lebung has strong armed me into it, and I had no option. All right. Well, that's all we got time for on that front. I hope that we've solved at least these two problems this morning. So, Lebang, your problem with the rehab question, I think we could tick that one off. Mash, your problem with your roommate. I do agree with Lebang. At least this roommate of yours is trying to cook things, because you do get those people who just they just sit on their backsides and you have to do everything. And those people, I think, are always a lot worse, don't you? I mean, like, you'd rather have someone who's making an effort.
That's much worse.
Yeah, so even if...
making an effort,
This person clearly has
I will actually teach her.
Yeah, and this person clearly has no skill in the kitchen, but you'd rather have that than someone who just doesn't care at all. So let's see what we can do here. A little bit of compassion.
Yeah.
Dear Linda says, absolutely, just to finish off the air fryer discussion, because this is never going to go away, thanks to Lebang. In fact, we're all excited that when she eventually does give birth, it'll be the first time on the show we don't have to talk about air fryers. Dear Linda says, it is an ugly machine. I do not like it in my kitchen. Now, is that true? Is it ugly?
I mean, you know, it's not about how you look on the outside. It's about the inside.
I've seen them. They don't fit into any kitchen.
They're huge. Like, it depends on the size that you get. Some of them are, like, massive. Some of them are, like, less massive. But they generally aren't supposed to be sexy machines. Like, they're there to do a thing. And the thing is prepare food, finish.
Is there anything you can't...
You know, it's not here to be in, like, a...
Anything you can't cook in these things?
I mean, I remember last time we spoke about it, the whole bap thing came about, whether you can make bap in the air fryer or not, and I haven't tried. But really, it seems like you can do a whole lot of crap in there, bro.
Do you see what you've done here, Mash? Do you see what you've done? She goes on a, like, tangent. She gets excited. She starts, like, getting all animated. Never seen the bung as excited as when
she doesn't have a bun in the oven. She has a bun in the air fryer.
Oh, my God.
That's beautiful. All right. Let me introduce our guest for this morning. He is a clinical psychologist, a criminologist, an advocate of the High Court, an interest in forensic and investigative psychology. And he's also got an interest in workplace threats, which I think we'll get into as well. He's worked at Westkoppie Psychiatric Hospital, famously, and in the South African Police Service as the section head of the investigative psychology section. These are amazing, amazing CV entries, but the man himself is also the head profiler, was for a long time, head profiler for the police, also successor to the legendary Mickey Pistorius, who you remember wrote a couple of books about forensic psychology, an expert on serial murder and rape cases. Gerard Labuschagne saw it all in his 14 and a half years in the SAPS. I'm very, very pleased to welcome him to the show this morning. Gerard, how are you?
Hi, morning, Gareth. Great, and yourself?
Good to see you, and thank you very much for making time for us this morning. It's really, what you do is just some people's favorite subject. You know, whole channels on DSTV that are dedicated to this stuff. And I'm sure Lebang and Mash are feeling the same way. There's so many questions I want to ask you. But did I get that mostly right? I mean, that's an incredible CV. That's an incredible list of skills and experience that you've had in your career. You must be quite in demand.
Well, you know, it was an interesting career. And I had great opportunities during the police. They really treated me very well. And I had fantastic opportunities, for example, train with people overseas or people that we brought out from overseas here. Whether my skills are in demand, you know, the reality is the police are the ones that deal with all the kind of crimes I used to work with. And, you know, they still have the old unit there that I was part of. So they kind of turn to those people, and there's still people with great skills there. So there's not really actually demand for a profiler in the private world, so to speak, which is why I spend most of my time kind of working on the workplace violence issues since I left. And that was a conscious decision that's what I'm going to be focusing on once I leave.
But surely there are lots of private individuals and even companies that are interested in hiring someone with your skill set, because you're able to figure out for them when something goes horribly wrong, whether it is something as drastic as murder and rape, or if it's something where someone is behaving very strangely. As a forensic psychologist, you can pick up on clues. You can deduce from behavior that there's something not right going on. Surely they ask your advice, even if it's in private institutions, about things that perhaps the state has ultimate control over, but where you can help them to figure out what's really happening in someone's mind, especially if they're a criminal sort of person.
Yeah. You know, so I do get contact every now and then by usually attorneys who have a client that's facing some, you know, usually a violent crime, where I might be asked, for example, to testify at the sentencing of this individual to sort of explain what sort of risk do they pose to society and how should the court deal with them from a sentencing point of view.
Yes.
I still get contacted by the NPA when they're doing prosecutions from time to time to testify in certain cases. It's kind of a mixed bag. You know, as I said, I did want to focus more on the workplace stuff when I left in 2016 and build that up. But I still do obviously love the good old fashioned violent crime stuff. I find it very fascinating. So that's kind of where I do still dabble in it, is really more from a court case perspective to get involved in stuff.
Well, there's no shortage of stories in South Africa from that point of view, right? You've written a book. It's in the background there, The Profiler Diaries. But tell us a little bit about Yeah, no, we like that. Be obvious about it. And it's good to see your book because people are going to want to know more after you've spoken to us a little bit today. But maybe you can share some stories from your profiling days of some of the interesting cases that you were involved in to just remind people and jog our memories a bit.
Yeah. Sure. You know, there were so many. It's kind of weird. When you're in the job, you don't really realize what you're in. It's really only when you left and you reflect upon it and you kind of go into a relatively normal life after leaving the police that you kind of realize, wow, you actually were involved in a lot of really interesting things. So it ranged anything from, I mean, I was involved in over 110 different murder series investigations in South Africa and one or two outside of our borders, for example, in Namibia, Swaziland, and then, you know, consulted ad hoc on some other ones over other parts of the world. And that's, I mean, a phenomenal number. If I used to speak to my profiling colleagues from other parts of the world, you know, if they worked on one or two murder series in their careers, that was a lot. You know, unless you were sitting at the FBI, they probably worked on also quite a lot of cases at their behavioral analysis units. But, it ranged from those to even more serial rape investigations. You know, Oscar Pistorius case, I was at the crime scene and then sort of spent most of the time in the courtroom sitting behind Gerry Nell. So it's those types of cases. And a lot of them that just really didn't make it into the media at all. And I mean, I'd sit in these courtrooms when we were prosecuting this person. I'm thinking, that's interesting. There's actually no interest in this case. So, you know, so that's kind of what some of the cases in the book are about. Some of them people would know, maybe more if you're an aficionado into sort of violent crime in South Africa. And other ones, it's cases that would never have even been on people's radars, really. And in the book, second book, which is actually out in August of this year, same kind of thing. It's very ingeniously called Profiler Diaries 2. there, it's also amazing cases that a lot of people my colleagues who proofread it said, wow, I didn't even know this existed. I have never heard of this case. So it's a nice mixture of stuff that if you've heard about it, you're going to get really a lot of deep insight into the case. And then, you know, stories that you might have never heard about that I think are equally as fascinating. And it was, like I said, it's just from a lot of it, I think about 98% of our cases, it was crimes against women and children. Ugh. So that was quite, you know, rewarding to be playing a role. And it ranged literally as the subtitle of the second book, from crime scene to courtroom, because, you know, we would be called out to crime scenes of an unusual case and would give input right then and there. We might stay involved in the investigation throughout, and then we might testify at the trial, or sometimes we're just called in to come give evidence right at the end at the trial phase. So it was really a spectrum of stuff from crime scene to courtroom. I mean, we used to go on arrests, we used to interview suspects, we would fly in helicopters. It was kind of really like your, to a degree, almost like what you imagine the profiler's life would be, but in reality, 99.9% of profilers are just sitting in the office, you know, going through case files. So it was kind of a really amazing time, and I do miss it, but unfortunately it changed with time, and wasn't the rewarding job that I kind of had experienced it was for the first, you know, 10, 12 years.
So it's an amazing thing. People are really drawn to these stories, and I wonder if you've figured out what it is that is so compelling for all of us when we watch these crime series, when we get ensconced in a case. You mentioned the Oscar Pistorius case, famously in this country. It had everybody transfixed for, 2 years? Everyone had an opinion. Suddenly everyone was a forensic psychologist. Everyone was a lawyer. Started using terms that none of us had ever used before because we suddenly thought we were involved in this case. And what is it about us that we are drawn to this macabre, grisly, dark side of humanity? Serial killers, murderers, rapists, the mind of a killer. You know, there's so many spin-off series, there's so many books that have been written. You actually had real life experience at the coalface with a lot of this. You met some of these murderers. You saw the crime scenes. Why do you think ordinary old us are so obsessed with this stuff?
Look, I mean, I'm totally guilty of that. I mean, my whole life and career has pretty much been about macabre and gruesome stuff. And I mean, I just, as a psychologist, just found it a fascinating extension of human behavior. You know, yes, you get mental illness, you get people facing daily challenges, and those are always interesting. But this is just such an extreme form of human behavior, and it's real. So I think for me, like many, it's just so different to who we are as people that I think it's interesting to dabble in it in a very safe way, which is by reading about it and following it, you know, the TV shows, etc. In a safe way, because we don't have to actually, you know, get involved in that kind of stuff directly. And I think also the fact that it's local. If you're looking at the local crime stuff, it's stuff that has happened. You know these places. It's not some far flung country in America and some small tiny state in the south. It's real. You know, you've seen these places on the nightly news when they talk about the weather, or you've been there, or you know someone there. So it's close by. But I also do think a lot of it, it's because the cases in the end are solved. And I think in a way that gives us some kind of sense of comfort that, wow, these things, these people can't be stopped. You know, that we do have the resources, they can be prosecuted and put away, and we know that they're in jail until Correctional Services Parole Board screws up and lets them out. So I think that's, you know, something that makes people feel safe to dabble in the really dark elements.
Jared, speaking of local cases, there's one that's obviously extremely popular right now, the Senzo Meyiwa murder case, which featuring, Kelly Khumalo. And what's your professional outlook on that case? I mean, don't tell me who you think did it, but like generally based on your experiences, what's your opinion on how that whole thing has just unraveled thus far?
I mean, that's just, that case has the makings of so many, a movie, or I think there's already a documentary on Netflix or something.
That's right.
Because of just the role players. I mean, in essence, it's a murder, but it's who was around, who's on the peripheries. It's like the Oscar Pistorius case in there, like you say. Look, I did play a little role, very tiny role, when I was still in the police. And after I left, I still spoke to some of the investigators. So I obviously don't want to get too in detail. But I think that a lot of the problems that we're seeing with this particular case, the issues about the crime scene, how it was handled, the police has created that problem for themselves. You know, it started when Jackie Celebi, 2006, shut down all our specialized units, all our task teams, and decimated our violent crime capacity for investigation. They tried to recover, and unfortunately, a lot of the people who were those detectives left. You know, they went to private industry, they went to banks, and got five times their salary, better circumstances, better, you know, perks, etc. And we haven't really recovered from that. And I've always found it amazing that why don't we have homicide units? You know, we'll have it at each police station, we'll have one or two people whose job it is to work with any unnatural death, which could be a road accident, a suicide, someone falling off the roof, murder, anybody who died that you weren't expecting to pass away. And you'll have that little lone detective dealing with 30, 40 dockets on their table. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster. And if we still had the old serious and violent crime units and their processes, which were the murder and robbery units, and of course they had a history of their own, but that kind of a unit where we say we're going to have a specialist team that covers maybe 10 police stations consisting of 20 detectives, five on a standby group. Whenever that's the case, those five people go out and manage it. Then we wouldn't really have these problems that were seen in a lot of these investigations where it's issues about how this crime scene was managed, what happened where. So we've created that problem, and that's exactly what happened with the Oscar Pistorius case. That would have gone to the Bronkhorst Trio Task Team, which had, I knew them personally, phenomenal investigators. We wouldn't have had the hiccups we saw initially with the Oscar managing the crime scene, etc. So that doesn't mean the case is going to get solved, but at least we don't see these embarrassing things playing out in the courtrooms that we are seeing in this and many other cases. Yeah. And at least here you're having decent prosecutor, defense counsel who are able to pick these things up. You know, what about cases we don't necessarily have the best prosecutor or best defense counsel, and this potentially bad evidence gets in and you have a wrong guy convicted or the right guy let off? And that's a very big consequences for society.
Yeah, the system often lets people down. I know one of the areas of particular interest to you, and something which we don't give any attention to, because once we send someone to jail, we think, well, that's them dealt with, is parole. I mean, this is a big, big story, and it's a massive problem in South Africa. Apparently, there's some very famous murderers who are up for parole or who have already been released from jail. We think they're going to be put away forever. How does that work, Gerard? Maybe you can give us some examples of where, you know, there's some awful, awful people who are not rehabilitated at all, who are going to continue to present themselves as a danger to society, and they're being released back onto the streets.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a phenomenal, and we, like you say, we always think, oh, if you know, a life sentence, you're gonna be there till you die. And there's a lot of misunderstandings about the whole life sentence concept. So in South Africa, when you get a life sentence, it is until the day you die, but the question is where you're going to be serving it. You know, and after, typically in the standard scenario, after 25 years, you will become eligible. Doesn't mean you're going to get it, but you'll become eligible for parole hearings, and then probably every 2 years you'll have a subsequent hearing. So from 25 years onwards, if you've got a life sentence, you have that potential to have parole at some point. And you probably will get it, to be very honest with you, at some point after those 25 years. There were a few exceptions where there were constitutional court rulings which brought forward the parole dates for some people sentenced during a particular time frame. And that was around 2006, 2007. If you were given a life sentence, you might be affected by that. So like Donovan Moodley, who killed Lee Matthews, should have actually had a parole hearing only for the first time in 2029. And then he became suddenly eligible because of these two judgments. Yeah, he became eligible, I think, 2019 or 2020. And the Matthews family did ask me to advise and consult with that particular case. And I can almost guarantee he's probably going to get it the next time around. I looked at that parole board and was just flabbergasted about how incompetent, to be honest with you.
Really?
Their decision-making.
So Donovan Moodley, I mean, this is a famous story. We all remember what happened to Lee Matthews. Yeah. There was that Formula One hotel. There was the dumping of the body out near Walkerville. I mean, we're not going to forget this story in a hurry because it happened in places in Joburg we all know. And it was such a horrifying story because, you know, these parents didn't even know where their daughter was. And then it turned out that there was this complete lunatic, this psychopath who had done all of this. His family seemingly didn't know he was crazy either. And now he's up for parole. Mm-hmm. Is there any chance in hell that Donovan Moodley's got better while he's been in prison?
I haven't seen evidence of it. Let me put it very tactfully that way. He spent basically... pretty much since he was sent to jail, convicted and sent to jail, he spent pretty much every single year trying to get appeals, get special hearings, get things overturned, denying it was him. His version changed about two or three times during this time frame. Did an LLB, and he says in his court papers, I did my LLB for the purpose of helping me deal with my old appeals. And I think he didn't, when all of a sudden, when these constitutional court judgments suddenly came up, he realized, oh my goodness, I'm not paying for a 2029 parole date. Oh, my goodness, I'm going to have parole now. I can't continue to say it's not me, because when you go to parole, you can't say I didn't do it. They don't want to hear that. So suddenly he's like, oh, no, it was me. I'm very sorry, and I accept responsibility for all my claims over the past 8, 9, 10 years that it wasn't me. And now suddenly he's trying to sit there in the hearing as if I'm this honest, pious person, I accept responsibility. No, you've been lying for the past 10 years, putting this family through horrible trauma every time this issue comes up. And now that you suddenly realize, oh my goodness, I can't go to parole saying it's not me, like I've been saying in all my court papers for the past few years. It's like you sat there, but my scariest thing for me is the parole boards. On the board, you don't have people like psychologists, social workers. You have sort of one or two representatives of the community. I think it's one or two DCS members, a policeman. And thankfully, in this case, the policeman actually picked up that they were trying to sneak this parole hearing through and then said, well, we can't do this. We need more information. And the Matthews family had been dealing with correctional services literally on a weekly basis, saying we want to participate. And they try to sneak it through. And then the policeman said, this is the Moodley case. Hang on a minute. Well, no. We have to stop this. And he contacted the prosecutor. And the prosecutor, who's been in contact with the Matthews family all these years, said, hey, do you know that actually they were trying to put a parole hearing through? Wow. And the Matthews family went, but we've been speaking to these people all the time, literally all the time. So it's really, really horrific.
Do we have any access to this stuff? I mean, can you as a member of the public go and watch a parole board hearing? Do you know when these happen? We famously hear about when, you know, like Janusz Walusz has his parole board hearings because it's newsworthy. Funnily enough, the Donovan Moodley situation hasn't made it to the news. Who else is up for parole at the moment that we should be careful of?
Well, that's the huge problem. There's on a daily basis, there's people coming up for parole. It's very worrying. And if although they're not public in the sense of I guess, a court case where anybody can just waltz in. I think they should be. But the problem is, you know, there's family members are supposed to have the opportunity to participate in these things. And like we saw, the Matthews family was, they try to sneak it through, even though they've been in direct contact with them all the time. So I think that, what about, you know, someone who's lives in an informal settlement whose son was murdered, how are they ever going to be knowing about these cases? I think there should be a public list on the website saying on this date, this person. Mm-hmm. I think the public should be able to register on an easy access system on the internet to register their update their phone number and email address or whatever contact form they prefer on a website linked to a suspect's prison number, saying that, you know, I want to be notified. That the correctional services can't turn around and say, oh, we didn't know how to get hold of this lady. We didn't have the details. We didn't have the information. That at least makes it easier that that can't be the excuse. And that they should be public, that anybody who has an interest should be able to sit in that and hear the deliberations. Because I was literally flabbergasted at you know, they wouldn't even allow my report that the Matthews family had asked me to compile to be even mentioned in that parole board. They said, nope, only the Matthews family can ask him questions. No other alternative evidence can be presented or arguments can be presented at the parole board hearing. It's just like, it's just written in a way. And if you don't think there's corruption at those parole boards, you're an absolute moron. You know, if we happily accept that there's corruption in the police, in the investigations, possibly not everyone, but that it's a possibility. We accept that there's a possibility of corruption amongst prosecutors. Mm-hmm. We're even starting to pretty much accept that there's potential for corruption amongst advocates, magistrates and judges. Yeah. Are you telling me there's no corruption when someone can release you halfway through your sentence, that there's no potential for corruption there? And if they don't have mechanisms in place, you know, lifestyle audits, reporting systems, etc., then you've just allowed corruption to flourish at a parole hearing. And if I look at it, I'm just thinking either these people are incompetent or they're corrupted, because the decisions and how they make them are just bizarre. I mean, we had Morne Harmsa, that guy who committed that sword attack at the school in 2008 in Krugersdorp.
Yes, I remember him.
I mean, he should never have been released. I actually did a parole assessment, an independent one in 2019, on a request from DCS. And the internal correctional service psychologist says there's no way you should be releasing this guy. He's a worse danger now than before he committed the crime because of certain things that have occurred over the past few years in prison. And then they released him.
So
there
he's
you go, into family's custody. And that's
so you're saying he's out there at the moment. He's out in South Africa, this guy who used the sword to murder people.
Yeah. 4th of March, he was released, despite correctional services psychologists still maintaining, still submitting reports saying there's no way you must release this. Ooh. And they kind of have, well, psychologists' reports are just, they're just one of the things we look at. It's like, okay.
Wow.
And you just ignore, seemingly. It's just bizarre. If you follow my Twitter feed, I always post these horrible parole, you know, incidents.
What's your Twitter handle? Let's put that up so people can follow you.
I think it's at G.
Well, while you're looking for it, let me just tell everybody on Cliff Central today, Gerard features in this week's episode of Beyond Madness, which delves into the psychology of serial killers, why we're so fascinated with them. Don't miss that in proud association with Adcock Ingram OTC, the sponsors of Brave, and of course, Professor Christopher Paul Szabo, who introduced us to you, Gerard, I'm very pleased to say. What's the Twitter handle?
Yeah, I found it. It's at GN Labuschagne, all one word.
Very good.
G for Gerard, N for November.
Gotcha.
And then LABUSCHAGNE. Yeah, right. I don't post a lot, but I think when I do post, it's hopefully sensible.
Full of very good.
Meaningful
this
stuff.
Is like such scary stuff, like literally just sitting here listening to all of this. I wonder about like actual rehabilitation, Jared. Like, is there a way where, you know, these people who have committed these crimes and who have participated in these extreme violent acts, can they truly, truly be rehabilitated to such an extent where we can say, okay, you can be led back into society, you are 100% fixed, go on with yourself, you know what? Is that possible, or is it just over for them, like it's done?
You know, when you're looking at these kind of people, your serial murderers, your Donovan Woodleys, and the people who've done like the outlandish, really kind of violent stuff, I think we have to be very skeptical about the possibilities for rehabilitation. You have to assess each individual. Firstly, you cannot have a blanket statement. But, you know, for people like serial murderers, we don't know why someone becomes a serial murderer or a serial rapist or a pedophile, to be honest with you. So we have to be very careful about saying, and this is what seems to be the view in correctional services, if you've been a good boy in prison, you're probably going to be released. And the argument was mostly, you know, for the most part, these people were good people outside. They just unfortunately had these very horrible behaviors that they would go out and exhibit in between. Also, they're not exposed to the victims that they are targeting, that they were targeting outside. And they're in prison because there's not a lot of female warders, and they're also not stupid. And they realize that attacking a female warden in prison is really, really stupid. They're not idiots. So we don't know what makes these people like this very often. So how do we fix them? That's the first problem, even if you had the best services in prison. And then, you know, the fact that they're behaving normally in prison is not a predictor of their external behavior once they're in the community. And, you know, they kind of seem to have this attitude, well, let's give them a second chance. They've been in prison for 15 years. They've been well behaved. They've done a few courses, these one-day courses that you just have to not fall asleep during. But you're giving the, you know, you're giving the victim at a first chance of death or rape. And it's just highly irresponsible. And we've seen, as I said, multiple examples now with these people being released and while on parole reoffending, getting arrested again a second time, and then reoffending a third time when they're on parole. It's like, what are the consequences for correctional services parole boards when these things happen? Because I think if we made the parole boards criminally and civilly liable for the outcomes of their decisions, I think we'd have a lot of people being released on parole.
Definitely. Mash, you've been quiet, but I know you've got lots of questions. Do you want to go ahead and ask something?
Yes, so I actually want to find out, so in terms of the parole boards, the board itself, who decides who's actually on that board? That's actually something I've been meaning to find out as well.
It's a good question.
So, I think it's determined by, I think, the Correctional Services Act that sort of says who can be and who is on it. Mm-hmm. And then I think, like, the members of the community, they put themselves forward and then they get selected to be on a particular region's parole board. But as I said, my biggest concern is, you should have, for example, a psychologist on a parole board. You should have a social worker on a parole board. Mm-hmm. So their argument is, but yes, correctional services psychologists write reports which get given to the parole board. But now you have someone who's not a psychologist trying to understand that report on the board, who reads out, the chairman would read out snippets of the report to the rest of the committee. And then that same chairperson who's not a psychologist might recommendations back to what kind of therapy the person should get. I mean, let me give you a good one. In the Donovan Woodley hearing that I sat in on, the end of it was, okay, Donovan, you're not going to get parole now. You should redo this course, one or two courses that you've already done. I don't know what the point of that would be. And then you must go for therapy for your love of money. And I'm like, my jaw just hit the table. I'm like, hey, where does this love of money even come up from? And I can imagine the psychologists, who I know lots of them, they typically say to me, we get these bizarre referrals from the parole board for things that we must now do therapy for, which have no basis in reality. So if you at least have a psychologist on the parole board who reads the other psychologist's report and says, this is a good report, this is a bad report, and perhaps we should make recommendations for this type of therapy. It's like me giving an orthopedic surgeon, hey, you must do funny knee surgery for a funny knee. I mean, this guy's going to think, well, you're a bloody idiot. What do you know about knee surgery? You're not an orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah.
Same argument. If you're not a psychologist, you shouldn't be recommending therapy. It's just bizarre. And the big kicker is people also think that correctional services know what the offender has done. They don't. It's not like a copy of the police docket goes with them to prison, or a copy of the court record, or even the judgment doesn't go with them. So literally when that person arrives at prison, at the sentence section in correctional services, all they know is that he found guilty of one times murder.
Yeah.
They don't know the substance of that murder. So you look at Oscar Pistorius, you know, that's one times murder. You look at Morne Harams, who chopped the head off of that, who tried to decapitate that one kid at school and murdered one and allegedly and attempted to murder three others. He's also one times murder. You know, then you get the Valcom killers who lured that kid to the graveyard, killed him brutally, cut up his body, skinned his face off, kept the body parts at home. That's also one times murder. But all three of those people have a very, very different risk profile.
Yes.
But you don't know exactly what he's done. So he can spin a snot story to you over the next 10 years and soften the version of how it was that he killed his girlfriend. What do you have as a comparison to decide, actually, that's not the truth. We know what this guy did. We know what the judge said. We know what it's X, Y, and Z. So the starting point is when they get to prison is they don't actually know what this guy really, really, from a substance point of view, actually did.
Who's the scariest person you've ever actually interviewed? Who's the scariest person you've encountered in all of this madness that you deal with, these fringe people, these murderers and serial killers and pedophiles and rapists? And who's the worst and scariest person that you just don't want to see ever again?
Well, look, I mean, you can look at it from the point of view as which one was I personally the most scared of interviewing. I would say probably that was, and that was Joseph Pandile Nchongwana from Durban. He decapitated a good few number of people over a couple of days. I think it was in 2013. I think that's in my next book, was my first book. And he was just scary because he was actually an ex-Blue Bulls rugby player. So he was massive. He was absolutely huge. And I was just worried that if this guy gets angry, he can literally put one hand around my neck and squeeze the throttle the life out of me. Luckily, my colleague was with me, and I knew I could run faster than him. So if things did go pear-shaped, I wasn't going to be the first guy grabbed. So he was just scary because he was massively huge and intimidating and really kind of had a sort of an aggressive look on his face. But I mean, I've interviewed other people who did a million times worse things that I didn't feel scared at all about my personal safety. Like, you know, Stuart Wilkin from Port Elizabeth. I mean, this guy, he had, you know, he killed street children. He killed his own daughter. He killed adult sex workers. He engaged in necrophilia. He engaged in cannibalism. He would sadistically torture his victims while killing them. I mean, he's probably the worst in terms of the spectrum of behavior, serial murderer. I mean, I spent 2 days interviewing him in prison, and I didn't, you know, sort of feel at all worried about my personal safety. So it's, and I mean, I've had death threats from people who just killed their girlfriend. You know, they didn't, I mean, that's bad enough, but I'm just talking in comparison to all the other stuff that I've seen. And, you know, who are sending me death threats, but I've never received a death threat from a serial murderer. So it's kind of this bizarre world where the most horrible, horrific people are not necessarily the ones you're the most scared of. And the people who've done something comparatively lesser want to kill you.
See Mash's face in this. He's got like the fear of God put into him. These people that you've met, you've sat opposite. It's horrible, right?
I am terrified. These people sound terrible. No. And my dad actually works for correctional services, so I've seen some of these people, so I'm even more terrified.
Yeah. I suppose
ultimately, the guy who's the true psychopath is the one that you always have to worry about, because they get vindictive and they don't ever change. Psychopaths are psychopaths till the day they die. So they really don't like you. They're going to not like you for probably forever until they find somebody else that they really don't, that they don't like for some other reason.
Oh my God. All right. Is there a way you can pick these people out? I mean, let's just cut to the chase here, because with don't answer it that quickly. I was hoping you'd have an answer for us, because this is what I think the real reason we watch these shows, I think the real reason we pay attention to these stories is because we're hoping to find a pattern so we can go, okay,
yes,
if someone does this, or if someone says this, or someone behaves this way over a prolonged period, they are clearly worth avoiding. And you've already answered it. You said there is no way to tell. You cannot pick out a serial killer or mass murderer or genocidal lunatic from a crowd, right? They blend in with the rest of us. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's the thing. And that 99.9% of their life, they're doing the normal things that we do. They've got a job of some sort. Many of them have a girlfriend. They're very, very normal. And that's, I think, what is so scary. If there were these people who lived these criminal lifestyles that you knew, don't go near that guy. He's going to steal your wallet, punch you in the face, do this to you. He's a bad person. He's aggressive. He's rude. That would be easy. And there are people like that. I mean, we tend to sort of avoid those individuals. But these types, the specific that we've been talking about here, they don't live that criminal lifestyle that would even give us a warning that this is just a bad person in general. But having said that, you know, people often say, how do I not become the victim of a serial murderer? Well, in South Africa, most serial murderers are targeting typically unemployed women, and they approach them and offer them a job. From your serial rapists to your serial murderers, like literally 98% of them approach a lady on the street and say, do you want a job? And because you have such a high unemployment rate, you'll find somebody who doesn't, or who wants a better job than the one they've got, understandably so, and will go with this complete stranger and walk with them, get into a taxi, get out of a taxi, and take a shortcut across the felt, and that's where they become the victim of their crime. So the easiest way to avoid becoming the victim of that is don't go alone with a stranger anywhere. And that's probably good advice that we should all be following. But can you pick them out? No. You know, this old-fashioned view that they're torturing animals, setting fire to things, wetting their beds, doing bad things. Yeah, you'll get a tiny, tiny percentage of serial murderers who do that, but probably the overwhelming percentage of people who do that are not going to end up becoming serial murderers. They might end up becoming very bad people, but not necessarily serials. So there isn't that easy way to pick out these people. They just live very bland, normal kind of lives, and which is why everybody's always surprised when you arrest so-and-so and they're angry at you for arresting so-and-so because he would never do that. He's such a nice person. well, you know, we've got his DNA linked to 20 murders and he's confessed. So much for that nice person.
This is what you always see, right? In all of these shows, all the news interviews, when a murder happens like this, the neighbors are like, oh, he was such a nice person. He was so normal.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy that we can never get beyond that. And you're here, you're the professional. You're telling us there is no way you could be sure. There's just no way. You can think you're living next door to a saintly, quiet, middle-aged woman, and meanwhile she's boiling someone's head in a pot on her stove. It's or in an air fryer, as Le Bang does, you know? That's what she likes to use.
But you know, even if you look at your more everyday crimes, like rape and child molestation, you know, like 75% of those are committed by people you know, in your family, in your daily interactional environment, friends of the family. Yes, there is always stranger danger, but you know, we need to be teaching people that you're more likely to be raped or a child to be molested by someone that you hang out and probably drink coffee with and share a meal with than you are by a stranger.
I'm afraid we're going to have to close the conversation on that note. It's there's so much. We could talk to you for days and days and days, Gerard, and I wish you luck with the new book. Please let us know when it's out so we can give it a proper plug and we can have you on the show again. Any excuse to get you back. People have got lots of questions here, and I'm sorry we didn't get to some of those. We tried to throw some of them into the mix this morning, but it's an absolute pleasure to speak to you. You can follow Gerard on his social media. It's at GN Labiskakhni. Go and take a look. And you can follow all of the tweets that he's going to put up there, all the latest stories, all the things he's following. It's amazing, amazing insights into the parole boards, which I thought Mash's question was really good too. Like, how do we even constitute these things and who decides who's on the parole board? So many things left unanswered, so many things that we'll leave for the next time we talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for joining us. And Le Bang and Mash, we'll see you next week. Le Bang, holding thumbs for 3.2 kilograms and growing in your tummy.
Why, thank you very much.
Right. Cheers, everybody.
Dumbbell.
Yeah. Oh,
cheers.
We'll see you tomorrow. Cheers, everybody. Bye. CliffCentral.com.